Hello everyone, welcome to another Food Mugs. I'm Vern and I'm joined by Jared. So in today's episode of Food Mugs, we'll be looking at how England have done in Australia, which historically has been a bit meh, if you're being nice to them. But yeah, so Jared, I think before you did the video on it, I didn't know they actually won 14 series in Australia.
Feels like a lot. Yeah. Yeah. I was a bit the same. I was like, really? It's that many series? And then I looked at the timeline of them and I went, oh, okay. It's not actually 14 series. It's 7 series before World War One and 7 series since World War One. So I think certainly early on they were the better team. And they were, you know, I know Australia shocked them a couple of times and obviously started the Ashes and won the original test match and everything. But I think if you go back up and, you know, up until World War One, Australia was starting to get better, but they weren't particularly great. And England had some really fantastic sides at that point. So yes, there was a period of time when England was a substantially better team than Australia. And then there's the last 100 years.
So like completely random question I had, by the way, over the first official Ashes series, right? So what happens is, England lose to Australia at the Oval in 82. Mm. And then you obviously have the obituary where like the body was cremated and like the ashes are taken to Australia. Which, by the way, I just want to say, if the Ashes was a TV show, that's the coldest opening of all time. I'd binge that show that day if that was the opening scene of it, right? Yeah. It's such a badass thing. But I was just looking at it. I think there's a 4 test match series that England play. They win 2 and lose 2. So how did they take the ashes back? That's still confusing me. So in the 3rd test match, I think the trophy is created and the urn is taken back to England. But they lose the 4th one.
No, right? So there's all sorts of things going on here. There's actually 2 Ashes stories, right? Mm. There's the actual article that you're referring to, which happens after 1882, right? So that's a one-off test series. Spofforth goes absolutely nuts. W.G. Grace runs someone out when they leave the crease after nodding at him. Hello, Alex Carey. And we're off at the races. The actual urn of the Ashes is later on. And it comes in randomly. It's not even like at an Ashes game. It's actually not far from where I grew up. It's a place called Sunbury. And they have like a one-off, they have a series. And during that, there is a thing where a veil or bales, still no one's exactly sure which one, are burnt and they're put in the urn at that point. So those are 2 different things separate to each other. So basically, like there's a, I don't think it was a newspaper, I think it was like a magazine or like a sports thing or something that claims the birth of the Ashes. And then there's a town in Australia that also claims the birth of the Ashes. So they're actually 2 different things. But yeah, once you start to retain them, that becomes a little bit different. You're right. And then it becomes very, very confusing.
No, but I actually mean that specific series. I think so. What I've read is that, so in the 3rd test match, it saw the creation of the urn and England were leading the series 2-1. But that was a 4 test series, which was actually a 2-2 draw. So did they actually gain anything or was it just a draw?
Well, you say the 3rd test match was when it happened. It's not at that test match because that test match was, that the actual game where the urn comes from is like a friendly game on that tour. It's a tour match, right? Mm. It's not even in Melbourne. It's outside of Melbourne. It's like in a country town called Sunbury, which is now like a suburb of Melbourne back in those days. So it's more random than that as well. But yeah, I think the idea was, oh, you guys have played well, so you could take the urn back now. You can take back your remains. I think that was the joke, right? Because you got to remember, this is all, we take it really seriously now, Varun. This is all just piss taking, right? This is a bunch of ladies who are burning some random shit and giving it to someone as a bit of a gag gift that has ended up being one of the most important sporting things that has ever existed. Like, that's how it all started. It started as a joke in a newspaper, a joke up at a tour game that has ended up. So yeah, I think that the idea was we'll just give it back. But realistically, I think you're right. It should have stayed in Australia. I'd have to go back and look at the full results. Because what year was the actual Ashes urn created? Then you're pushing me on that.
I think it was 82, 83, I think.
It's just after. Yeah. Then yeah, technically you're right. It shouldn't have left Australia.
Yeah, that's what I'm confused
if you're
about.
Right.
That's
one of the things that, to be honest, yeah. I haven't done that much. I've played cricket. I've hosted an event at the club that had it once before. It was me, Gideon Haig, and Shield Berry, and there were more people from my family at the event than there were actual spectators that came to watch us talk. But it was very nice to be at the original club, and they talked quite a lot about the Ashes there and everything else.
Like, my favorite thing about the Ashes isn't even like the history, the nonsense surrounding it. It's the actual name. It's such a cool name. It's by far the best name in cricket. Like it just came from nowhere, right? And as I just said, like that opening sentence of like the newspaper article would be a great hook to a TV show that I would binge in a day, right? It's so good.
It's also like there's little things about it too. Like, so Steve Harmison talks about, I think it's winning in, it must be 2005, and they lift the urn. And of course, in his mind, he's thinking it's the Ashes urn. And when they lift it, he could see the sticker underneath that they've got it from the tourist shop. Like they just bought an urn.
Michael Wan says it as well, right?
Yeah. And so like, you know, it the whole thing's ridiculous. You've got all these other trophies in sport. And everyone's trying to be like the Ashes. And the Ashes is just taking the piss from the start, right? Like everything about it is piss taking. So back in those days, it was very communal. Like I think maybe even the woman who burnt the bales might have ended up having a love affair with the England captain or something. Like there's a lot going on, man. She might have been the first, I was going to say wag, but I don't even think that they actually officially got together. I'm not even sure. I wouldn't want to look into his personal history, but there was certainly, there was some sex, there was some Ashes, and there was a joke in a newspaper. And from that, we have one of the biggest marketing rivalries in the history of sporting history.
So let's actually start off with the only Ashes win England had whilst I was alive, which is 2010-2011. So that's the one I'm like reasonably familiar with. From what I know, it's that England make big runs. They have the bowlers that take the wickets, and Australia also going through like a bit of a transition phase at that point, right?
Yeah,
great batters are started to retire. Yeah. The bowlers you started to come up and all of that, right?
Yeah, I mean Mitchell Johnson obviously plays in that series, and Steve Smith plays in that series. So there is an element of it's not that bad aside, and Ricky Ponting's there, and Mike Hussey and Simon Cadditch. There's a lot of very talented players, but I think Cadditch and Ponting don't make any runs. In fact, I think Ponting actually gets injured in that series as well. Just Michael Clarke might end up captaining, I think. And it just all sort of fell apart for them. That was probably the only time in my lifetime where I thought England were the way better side coming to Australia, right? There were maybe other times, like this series is one where you're just like, you can make an argument that England is a better team, but you could also make an argument that Australia isn't far off. I don't think you can make much of an argument there. I think when your bowling attack is Mitchell Johnson, Ben Hilfenhaus, Peter Siddle, and Michael Beer or Xavier Doherty. But does Harris play much in 10-11?
Yeah, he plays 3 tests, I think. Yeah. I'm just looking this up.
So he plays a little bit. I think that was before Harris was kind of the force that he becomes over the next couple of years as well. So, you know, that wasn't a particularly strong side, but on paper, as I said, Harris, Johnson, Steve Smith, Ponting, you'd be like, wow, what a team that they beat. But it did not feel like that when you're watching that series. Like Mitchell Johnson wasn't Mitchell Johnson at that point. Ryan Harris wasn't Ryan Harris. Steve Smith wasn't Steve Smith. Ricky Ponting wasn't Ricky Ponting. Like you can go down the line, the guys weren't really at that level.
Yeah, so going back to your point, the top three, I think I was just looking at this, are make no runs in that series for them, right?
Yeah.
I think if you just look at it, so Ponting is averaging, he's averaging 16 in that series. Phil Hughes averages 16. Marcus North averages 16. Michael Clarke averages 21, right? Yeah. Simon Cattage averages 24. So they mainly get their runs from Shane Watson, Brad Haddin and Mike Hussey, right? Those are the only three guys who consistently make runs for them, which is actually weird. I know Australia win 2013 and 14, but it's actually a very similar pattern there as well. They're mainly carried by the middle order. Just the difference is the bowling side, the same bowling side actually, weirdly enough, becomes so much better in 2013 and 14.
Exactly.
And England's batting regresses to hell in that series.
No, there's almost a complete switch, isn't there? Like Jonathan Trott's one of the best players in 10-11, and by 13-14, he's done, right? Like it goes that violently, that switch. But no, I think you're right. I think there's certainly an element there of, on paper, it's a confusing series. But if you were there watching it, it was just clear that England was so much better. I got so much flack when I landed in Australia from Australians because I was saying, we're not going to win this, right? And Australia couldn't even get their head around the fact that they wouldn't win that series, right? And I was like, this team's really good and our team is not really good. And when Australia started well, I remember like, you know, this is back in the Cricket with Balls days. I had a podcast, I think, as well. We were doing the two chucks. So I had all these different I was just getting hammered by Australians. And by the end of the series, no Australians were watching it. Like they had been so badly beaten that they kind of just like disappeared.
Yeah. So I think, as I was just saying, so that was also probably the series where Australia just didn't have a spinner, right? England, I think you were saying
this. How dare you say that about Michael Beer?
Was Michael Beer even playing that series?
I reckon he plays at Perth. And I think they picked him.
He does play a test, yes.
Okay. This shows you how bad Australian cricket was at this time, right? Mm. And it's incredible to think back that this is 14 years ago, 15 years ago. when he was picked for Perth, he was picked because he was playing for Western Australia and they wanted a specialist spinner for the Wacker, right? But I happen to know that Michael Beer was from Victoria, and apparently the selectors did not know that. And I went back and looked at the records on Cricket Archive, and it ended up being in all the papers. Everyone ran with my stat from Cricket with Balls. It was hilarious. Of like, he'd played 4 or 5 games at the Wacker in his life. Like, he was no one's idea of a specialist at the Wacker, Michael Beer. But they had no idea what they were doing. They were panicking. And do you know why Michael Beer and Xavier Doherty were playing in the first place?
No.
Kevin Peterson.
Oh, of course. His left-arm finger spin error. Right? I remember this now.
So yes. It was just, it was so nuts. The whole thing was so entirely nuts. And watching Xavier Doherty bowl, like, so in the second inning, so Australia actually, as I said, started well. In the second innings of that first test, England make 517 for one, which is an extraordinary second inning score, no matter how you look at it, right?
Yes.
And Xavier Doherty, of course, bowls to Strauss, Trott, and Cook. And KP never even comes out to bat.
I love that top three, by the way. That's like a very like old school, like non-woke batting top three, where it's like our three guys are going to all have a strike rate of 42, and they're going to, like, it doesn't matter if 100 for 175 overs. Jonathan Trott will come out and he'll make 50 of 150. It doesn't matter what situation we're in, right?
It's, but you know, there was a lot of Moneyball thinking behind their top three. So their theory was what you want is to have your attacking players in the middle and have your defensive players on top, and tire out all the bowlers. So by the time KP comes on and everyone else comes in, Bell and Pryor, etc., that your bowlers are, the opposition bowlers are tired, and you can score really quickly and then cash back in that particular way. So there was actually, it was kind of a new age way of going about it, but it was also, you know, it's kind of the end of Andrew Strauss's career. Like, you know, he didn't last all that much longer. And Jonathan Trott has this miraculous career, but it's a very short career.
Yeah, he's a bit of a peak batter, right? He comes in late in his career and just has a great run, and then probably not very good when he was young, and not great once he's older, I think, from memory. They also like paired an incredible batting lineup with like really good bowlers. Like, this is the one good Ashes series Jimmy Anderson has, right? And that's in Australia, because Jimmy doesn't really have a great home or away Ashes on either side of that. Like, it's actually, everything went right for England. Like, even Graeme Swann, for example, on paper doesn't have a great series, but like, if he's averaging 40 and the Australian spinners are averaging like 120, like, that's a very good series for a spinner.
So the other story I broke during that series was Stuart Broad injured. And I didn't know what to do with the story because I was a blogger at the time, right? So I told David Hopps and Lawrence Booth, and Hopsy went to Mike Selvey and said, Jared's just come up to me and said that Stuart Broad is going home, because I saw him in the net. And I was like, there's no way he can bowl, right? He's out of this test. He's probably out of the series. Because, you know, those big medicine balls, you sometimes see fast bowlers bounce them. He couldn't get it to bounce. And I was like, he's done, right? That's it. If he can't get that to bounce up to knee height, he's done. And Mike Selvey talked to, I think it was David Saker, the bowling coach. And Saker was like, no, I don't know what he's talking about. And of course, the next day they announced that Broad was going home. So they actually lost one of their more Australian style bowlers on that series, and still it didn't matter, right? That's, you know, that's just how good they were playing at that point.
Yeah, so Chris Tremlett takes 17 wickets in 3 tests at 23. They also had Stephen Finn, who again, like, went out 4.3 runs per over, but was still taking a wicket every 46 balls. So it's probably the strike bowler. You had Bresnan come in for a couple of tests, and then you obviously had Graeme Swann just holding one end up, and Jimmy as almost like your stock bowler in that series, right? So it's also like surprising to me, like, both teams had 4-man attacks, right? And on really like flat-ish pitches, right? They were bowling so many overs, Jared. I think all of them like were averaging like 40 overs a game, which to me seems nuts, even in 2025.
I was going to say, it's a very, like, you just wouldn't see that now, would you? Like, it's really different to what you would see now.
Yeah. So I think overall, so I think this is like, you keep saying this, right? It's a pattern that to win in Australia, you usually need to bat big, nullify the spinner, have fast bowlers who can take wickets. Everything went right for England in that series, right? And that's, it's very rare for England for everything to go right. Usually with England, there's an England in Australia, there's an element of Murphy's Law where everything that can go wrong will go wrong. Yeah. So like all the bowlers get injured, the batters lose form and everything. But this series, everything goes right. And it shouldn't be surprised to us that they win, right? As well as they also have Australia going through like the worst phase at that point after a long time on top of that. So everything just went right for them. And they win 3-1 with 3 innings victories on top of that, which is crazy.
Yeah, I think the vast majority of the wins that England have had in Australia, and we'll talk about this as we go through it, but the vast majority is kind of have 3 things in common with each other, right? Which is they have Australian-style fast bowlers, which in Bresnan, Finn, and Tremlett, they kind of had it. They had Broad as well when he was playing. they have the ability to make scary big runs. So it's not just making runs. You have to make runs that break Australia, right? Like it's the sort of totals that Australia make against other teams, which is hard to do. And then the third one is that Australia generally in the series that they have lost have generally had weaker batting, right? So if you go through the, you know, almost all the losses since World War One, there's been an element of Australia having weaker batting in quite a few of them. And 10-11, you have, that's the triumvirate. And I think it might be the only one that has all three, or maybe it's not Bodyline, because Bodyline would have Bradman. There might be one other series that has all three, but there aren't many. So generally, England, if they have two of those things go in their favour, win. And if they have three of those things go in their favour, good luck. Brian Lara used pot plants to work on his placement. John Wright glued his glove to his bat. Sachin Tendulkar dug up practice pitches. Tatenda Taibu cut the top off his bat. Claire Taylor used a hockey grip. Steve Smith was from tennis. Dean Jones would call phantom runs. And Victor Trumpa turned the Nets into a war zone to survive. The best batters in the world do whatever they have to make runs. We have told their stories in our new book, The Art of Batting.
So would you say, like, after, let's say, the World War era, this is the one series when England have everything goes in their favour?
Yeah, I think it's certainly, I don't have all the metrics in front of me at the moment, but in fact, I do, but I'd have to bring it up while we're talking. But I can bring it up right now. I'll just see if there's any other series. Was it 28-29? No. 54-55. Yeah, I think 10-11 might be the only one that ticks every single box that I've just said, right? And you're right about the spinner, but there are actually some series where, like, Australia's spinners still do really well. Like, Bill O'Reilly does really well in a series. I think Bert Ironmonger. There's another series where, I can't remember who the Australian spinner was, but he did very well. So you can get by if the Australian spinner is still doing something, right? But what you really need more than anything else is that incredible talent to be able to have two of those things go in the right way. And that this is probably not just for England. I would say if you go all the way through, anytime anyone's done well in Australia, it's probably a combination of these sorts of things that need to happen for you.
So the next series we'll be talking about would be the series in 1979 and 1980, right? But England, I think, win 5-1, if I'm not wrong.
Yeah.
So I think you talk about how that was probably, like, flatters them a bit, because that was the World Series period, right? Where Australia just didn't have their best players, and England also had, like, a really solid bowling attack on top of that, with both of them at his absolute best as the all-rounder.
Yeah, so I that was probably the one I paid the least attention to because of what you just said. If you go back and have a look at Australia's team on paper, like, you're probably not going to know who these dudes are, right? Like, even hardcore cricket fans are going to struggle to know who they are. It's obviously still quite an important win for England. And if you look at it, they have a win at the start of the 70s and they have a win in the middle of the 80s. So I don't think it's complete, like, it's not like they might not have been good against a better Australian side, but it was a B-side. Kerry Packer is happening at the same time. All the best players for Australia are not playing. The vast majority of the best players are playing for England. I think they don't have a couple. They don't have Tony Greig and a couple of others. But Australia is just like a hollow shell of themselves. So I don't think you can take too much out of that series.
Yes. So I think you also say, like, in a few years later, they win again in 86, 87. Yep. This I would assume would be, like, even though Australia, I know that's the weak era, but it's not, like, it's not weak because of other reasons. It's just weak because they're just going through, like, a bit of a lull phase, right? There's no external factors coming in play.
No, they had Marsh, Lilly and Chappell retire in, what, 85-ish, right? Mm-hmm. So basically three of their best players just sort of disappear. And because of that, they end up on the other side of not being, you know, particularly good. But also they are building towards something, and so they're picking a lot of younger players. So they've got guys like Dean Jones, Merv Hughes, Steve Waugh, David Boone in that side, who are, some of them are a bit more developed than others, but they're still coming through, right? They're not quite the finished products at the moment. So it is a quite a weak side. Just when you said before, by the way, that 10-11 was the only Ashes you were alive for, right? England Ashes win in Australia you're alive for. This is the, I've only been alive for two, and I've been alive almost double the amount of time you've been alive. So it does tell you just how rare this happens, right?
Yeah, so the hallmark of this series for England was like they make a lot of big innings, right? They make 592 in 170 overs, 456 in 134 overs, 455 in 148 overs, 349 in 120 overs, right? So they batting a lot of time, and they also sometimes make really big runs, so, which again goes back to one of the things we were talking about, is you have to tire the bowlers out.
Yeah, the only thing I would say about this series is I think there's – I don't want to say it's a fluke because I don't want to have a go at the 86-87 boys because that's the wrong way of putting it. But when you look at the test, they win 2-1, right? But when they win 2-1, it's essentially every single time they needed to bowl Australia out, one bowler just puts his hand up and takes up a 5-wicket haul, right? And it's remarkable how often it happens and really, really helps. And some of those bowlers don't even have, you know, particularly great series. In fact, I think 3 of the 4 top run scorers are Australians in that series, despite what you just said about the amount of runs. So I think that is probably the series that could have easily flipped in another direction. Right. Like, I think it could have ended up being a draw or even Australia winning 2-1 if something had slightly gone their way. You know, Gladstone Small doesn't go on his run or whatever that may be. I don't know how you felt about it. I thought this was maybe the least impressive of their wins, just because it did feel like Australia could have actually done something here. There's another one that we'll talk about, which is quite interesting as well.
Oh, is this the series with the Typhoon or is that the different one?
Typhoon is 54-55.
Of course.
That one is, I think those are the two where you look at them and go, if these were played a bunch of times again, England maybe don't win. Maybe England win 30% of the time, not any more than that. Whereas 10, 11 and, you know, some, you know, 70, 71, whatever that was, and those sorts of ones, I think in those situations, England would win the vast majority of those, even if they were played back a bunch of times. Do you want to talk about 54-55?
Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about 70-71 before and get it out of the way before we get to the main one?
Yeah, yeah. So what do you think about 70-71?
So I was just looking this up. So England in 2 test matches and draw 4, just automatically that tells me that's a lot of batting involved in that. The moment I say 4 draws, I'm like, okay, there's probably some flatties in there.
I'm not sure they were all draws though. Wasn't one abandoned?
Was one abandoned?
I think one was abandoned without a ball. So I'm not sure it is sometimes marked as a draw, but I don't even think that counts as a draw. So I think the first 3 tests... where 2 was drawn and 1 was abandoned at that point. So yeah, that's a really odd start to a series, right?
Yeah, also like weirdly, like for a batting series, the highest score isn't actually that high. So if the highest score England had was like 470, which I think if this was a very good batting series, because they averaged 42 overall, that feels like a very low high score to me.
I think if you look at England, they made all their runs in the top 3, like just a metric shit ton. They had 2 players score over 600 runs in this series in the top 3. And they had, you know, incredible partnerships between Boycott and Luckhurst and Boycott and Edridge. I think between those 2 partnerships, they almost scored 1,000 runs. But I don't think they put that many runs in. And then there's only one bowler in the series. For those Game of Thrones fans, Jon Snow was just absolutely remarkable. And again, you're talking about another series like 10-11 where they have a bowler who is very Australian style. Jon Snow was really... Jon Snow wouldn't be out of place in like a modern Australian bowling lineup, I don't think.
Yeah, I've definitely heard a lot of things about Jon Snow in cricket for some reason. Like more than I've heard about him from... Was it in Game of Thrones that Jon Snow exists?
Yeah, you're not a Game of Thrones guy.
I have not watched Game of Thrones at all. Okay. It's one of those things where I'm like... It's like I can't be asked to get into it. Like I think I missed the window. So maybe like later.
Have.
That and Breaking Bad are the 2 shows I think the windows I've missed for.
We just so watched like, Breaking Bad with the kids the other day, the last couple of weeks.
Is that a show you watch with kids?
Well, I mean, who doesn't want to watch a dad become a drug dealer and become really rich? I think that's what all kids are hoping for.
To be fair, you're a bit of a crackhead at times, so I think it adds up. So.
Also, you don't want to go into the sort of weird shit I show my kids because like it freaks out the other parents as it is.
But yeah, so again, like, so would that be Boycott at his best, you would say? Like, at least peak years, I want to say.
Yeah, I suppose it is, right? Like, I think we'd probably have to go back through the numbers, but it's a lot. I think it's the series that he gets a lot of credit for because, again, they don't really win another real series, right, until 86, 87, and then not another one until 10, 11. So, you know, that series, there's no question marks or anything on that. Like, I know you talked about the washouts and everything, but they are clearly the better team in that series. Their batting is so much better. And the Australian bowling lineup is just not good. It's one of the weaker ones you'll see for an Ashes, especially at home. And England just mop up.
Yeah, so I think you were just saying in the piece that the openers make over 500 runs as a pair, and then Boycott and the and Eldridge make over 400 runs, right?
Yeah,
so Eldridge make over 400 runs as a pair.
Yeah, 437. That's what I said before. It's like 900 runs yeah. in partnerships.
That's a lot of runs. Boycott That's a lot guys. Of partnership runs.
I mean, you obviously get the odd fluke series, but you don't really get stuff like that all that often. That is, for me, that feels like a really, really outlier moment.
All right, let's get to 54-55, Jared. I think this was the series I think you immediately, like you told me about before, like you were really excited about this because of the typhoon. Talk us about the typhoon, Jared. I have no idea who that is, but let's talk about him.
So England isn't really famous for fast bowlers, right? Like if you go through their history, obviously they had Tom Richardson, they have Larwood. So they've had a couple, but the vast majority of times when we're talking about fast bowlers, South Africa and Australia are probably in that conversation, and then the West Indies, right? Frank Typhoon Tyson was unquestionably one of the fastest bowlers in the world. He was an absolute machine of pace and everything else. And so, but this series is so much more fascinating than just him, because essentially Australia win the first test by an innings and 154 runs and yet lose the series 3-1, right? And the second test, they had a huge chance of winning when the Bob Appleyard, which by the way, one day you're going to have to look up Bob Appleyard because he has one of the most incredible careers of anyone ever as well. Bob Appleyard and someone else makes runs and for the last wicket. They put on 46 runs for the last wicket and then they end up winning the test match by 38 runs. And essentially at that stage, the series is kind of like over. And Typhoon takes 6 for in that one. And then I think in the next time he takes 7 for, right? So these two just huge spells of bowling in the second innings. And when we looked him up, he has a bowling average of 29 in the first innings, Varun, and a bowling average of 9.5 in the second. Like, who does that? Like, he didn't play a lot of test matches.
That is insane.
I mean, I don't know if we can go through the first class record on Cricket Archive or something and work out whether he did this all the time. But that is incredible. But he was very, very fast, and Australians love him. He actually moved to Australia after he retired. I think him and Larwood both did, actually. So they were almost more loved in Australia than they were in England. And that series was literally Australia wins the first test match and then runs into a typhoon.
Sorry, I was just looking at the second and third test match. Just looking at the scorecards, they would not look out of place in the pace playing pandemic.
Yeah,
just like how the game's progressing. They feel like a few South African tests I've seen.
It's certainly a very low scoring series, isn't it? I think even with that, Typhoon stood out. But that was what was interesting is that England had a really good bowling attack, but Australia had a really good bowling attack as well. But Australia's batting was just a little bit weaker. So you've got the combination of the Australian style fast bowler, and then you've got the weak Australian batting. And you know that pattern just keeps coming up again and again.
Yeah, so that was, again, it's a fascinating series, just looking back at it, right? So in 1928 and 29, England win 4-1 in Australia, right?
Yep.
So this is a series where they score a lot of runs, right? You said, I think they scored only 300 in one completed innings once in that series, which is quite insane to me, right? That was also be just when the runs start coming in Test cricket, right? That would be the period once we had an established career. That's post the solid manure and all of that. So batters were just starting to come in, right?
Yeah, this is really the period where like everyone becomes Jack Hobbs, right? So you have, if you think about 28, 29, you have Hammond, Headley, Sutcliffe, Bradman, right? And Hobbs is still playing, by the way, at this point. And on the back of that, obviously, Hutton comes in not long after as well, right? So, and some other great batters who also did some incredible things. So, yeah, it's the period of which people kind of clock batting is maybe the best way of looking at that late 20s. Mm. How many runs did Wally Hammond make in that series?
How many runs did he make in that series?
Because we just said that Boycott and Edridge made over 600, and we were like, that's pretty good. Mm. I think Hammond might have.
That was just the 800 run series.
I think he makes 900.
905. Yes. Of course, it's the iconic series.
So just ridiculous, right? And again, in this particular one, I think England have I think they have a more traditional English bowling attack, but with Larwood. So they still have a little bit of that hit the deck faster kind of bowler, or in Larwood's case, he was more skiddy, but they have more of that sort of out and out Australian style pace bowler available to them. And they're also making a ton of runs. And what's fascinating there is that Clary Grimmett was the best bowler in the world, and he just has a shithouse series. And there really isn't, Australia doesn't have much other bowling in that series as well. So England, but that's why that allows England to make these ridiculous totals all the way through. And then the bowling attack and Larwood sort of mop up.
Oh, wait, sorry. I was just looking at the bowlers for a second. White bowl 400 overs in 5 test matches, Jared. Like, I'm just looking at the bowling strike rates. It's like everyone's like around 98, 104, 76, 86, 131, 90. Like, that feels like an insane highly high bowling strike rate for all the bowlers. Was this the timeless tester?
It would have been. I think Australian tests were timeless at that point, actually.
Feel like there's no way you could have a 5-day test match with these bowling strike rates.
But I don't know if they were longer than, because there weren't many test matches in Australia that went much longer than 5 days, though. Let's have a look here. The fifth test is quite long. The fifth test starts on the 8th. Oh, no, wait, that's wrong.
Yeah, 8th to the 16th, right?
Yeah, 8th to the 16th. The fourth test is the 1st to the 8th. I can't see the dates of the other one. 14th to the 20th, that's a little bit more normal. So, yeah, they were quite long. You know, and again, that should have played into Clary Grimmett's hands, because he could basically just bowl nonstop, right, from one end. But it doesn't, for whatever reason. He just doesn't. And you know, we'll talk about him in a moment as well, but he struggles again in the next series. So he had a lot of big series for Australia, but for whatever reason, those two Australian series didn't go well. But yeah, it is ridiculous. Look at Morris Tate's strike rate, by the way.
I should have looked at this. Where is Morris Tate? Yeah, 131. This feels insane to me, Jared. It's like... This bowling, the cricket was so different back in the day, man.
I have travelled the cricketing world, and so I've collected two things. The phone numbers of random taxi drivers and overseas SIM cards. Rideshare apps have fixed the first part, and Sally is doing the second. Now, all you need is their eSIM on whatever plan works for you. You activate it, and you can use it anywhere in the cricketing world. It helps you save money. It is a global solution to a global problem. Stop fiddling with tiny sims and get the one that does it all. Go to Sally.com Good Areas and use the code Good Areas to get an exclusive 15% off your first purchase. Fly free with Sally.
He played 5 test matches. He takes 17 wickets and he takes a wicket every 130 balls. But his economy is 1.87.
Indeed.
So, yeah, this is a fascinating one because, as I said, it's sort of... This is just kind of, you know, before Bradman becomes any sort of an important player or anything like that. So I'm trying to think, does Bradman play? Yeah, Bradman plays 4 tests and he makes the 200.
Only averages 67.
Yeah. He averages 40. You're right, 67 in that one. And makes the 200s. But it's kind of before they know that Bradman is Bradman, if that makes sense. They're kind of learning who Bradman is at that point. So he's just a young guy who's made runs rather than the force. But he makes what? 468 runs and is the fifth highest scorer in that series, right? Mm. Hammond makes 900. Ryder makes almost 500. Woodfull almost makes 500. Hendren makes 472. And then Bradman comes in at 468. Like, and Hobbs is just behind at 451, right? Like, even Sutcliffe, who has a bit of a down test, still averages, down series, still averages 50 there. And Jardine averaged 43 as well. Like, it's a ridiculous series for top order players, that one. And Australia probably...
Four test looks insane, by the way. So the scores were 334, 383, 369, and 336. That's insanely even. That might be the most even test scorecard I've seen so far.
Yeah, no, it's phenomenal, isn't it? It's so close. So there was lots going on in that series, but I think England just had the bowling attack and Australia didn't have the bowling attack. So there was a big difference between that. But again, it is England just making humongous scores. So if you look at the first test, they start by making 500. In the second test, they start by making 600. The third test, they make 400. Then you've got your favorite test in there. And then the fifth test, they make 500. Like, it's just so many runs. They just overwhelm Australia completely.
Yeah, also the amount, how long they were batting as well, is it looks absolutely insane, right? It feels nuts when you look back at cricket was, again, just so different, Jared. I think it's like those bowling strike rates again, like I still can't get over that.
And they would have been 8 ball overs as well. So you would have just been watching Morris Tate come in, bowl 8 dot balls, take a break, come back and bowl 8 dot balls again.
What was I actually looking at?
So you're up to Bodyline.
Ah, yes. Are we talking about Bodyline in this piece?
Yeah, because I think it's quite fascinating because they win 4-1 in Australia in 28-29, and then you look at it on paper and they win 4-1 in 32-33, and you're like, oh, well, nothing's changed. They were just a better side, and they came back. And it's like everything has changed in the middle of this, right? So Australia's gone from having one really good bowler in Grimmett to having two great bowlers in Grimmett and O'Reilly. And Bradman is Bradman by this point. And so England's entire theory is around Bradman.
And Bradman is just coming off the 974 series, right?
Exactly. And so they are setting up a situation where they are trying to bowl a particular way at him. And so for those who don't understand why it kind of works, the Bodyline series, it's essentially that even gloves were not particularly very protective at that point. Like go back and have a look at gloves from the 1930s. They were not, if the ball's hitting you on the finger, you're probably breaking your finger, right? At the very least, you're busting your finger. So the gloves weren't very good. They didn't have proper box protectors. They didn't have proper thigh pads. They didn't have arm guards. They didn't have chest pads. They didn't have helmets, right? And so England is bowling, I think it's been, no one could quite work out how much, but it's about 20 to 30% of their deliveries are bouncer style or short ball style, right? And then on top of that, that had never happened before. The technology wasn't there to help the batters. And then you have the fielding positions where you can have a leg slip, a leg gully, a fine leg, a deep backward square, and a backward square leg if you wanted to as well. Like you can have like 5 people behind square on the leg side and then just bowl at the body the entire time. And on top of all that, not only did they have probably the fastest bowler in the world in Harold Larwood, they also had the best left armer in the world in Bill Vose, who now we know through Neil Wagner what left arm bouncers can do to you. No one even knew that back then. So there are so many things that went in England's advantage. But again, you're talking about a series in which England tried what you would suggest is a more Australian method of bowlers in Bill Vose and Harold Larwood, a much more what you would consider conventional Australian bowlers, right? Rather than, you know, Morris Tate, who we talked about before, who's much more a conventional English bowler. So again, we're seeing that side of things come in. But they also prepared for that series in a way that no one had ever prepared for a series. They literally got footage of Bradman and played it until they saw the weakness, right? Or what they perceived to be the weakness. He still averaged over 50 in that series, by the way.
Yeah, like again, like I think you kept saying this, right? Like this is obviously a very controversial series, like the whole spirits of cricket stuff, right? And then you always say like England were technically correct to do what they do for that rules at the time. And I tend to agree with you. Like if the laws say you can do it, you should be able to do it. Like it's obviously the method was patched almost for after a while. But how quickly was the method patched, by the way? Was it almost instantaneous or was it like 20 years later? That sort of thing?
So it's really fascinating. The West Indies do it once, maybe twice. And I think they did it to Hammond as well. So it wasn't even, Bradman wasn't even the first guy it had happened to. And it happened, I reckon it happened in a county game as well, if I'm remembering correctly. So a couple of teams had tried this before. The Bodyline finishes and Jardine and Larwood are really thrown away, right? They are really treated poorly for what happens. And so teams just stop doing it, mate, right? The actual patch that you're talking about, the fielding position patch, doesn't happen until the mid-50s, so what, 20
that's
years
what I, later? That's what I thought it was, yeah, 58 or something, right?
I can't remember the exact year, but I'm pretty sure it's in the 50s, yeah. This is the funny thing. It wasn't brought in to stop the bouncers because people weren't bowling the bouncers. It was brought in to stop off-spinners and in-swing bowlers because they were bowling with like 3 leg slips. If you go back and you watch some of the fields, like when Peter May's batting, because he's a really good leg side fielder, everyone's behind square on the leg side. It looks ridiculous. It's such a weird field. And so it was so controversial that even though it was a great strategy, no one really did it after that. But I mean, to be honest, I don't think also that, you know, the technology hadn't caught up with the cricket, right? Like we might have, if people had kept bowling in the Bodyline style, we probably would have had to make the pitch longer at that point. Like, because I think baseball does something quite similar, right? Where they were like, oh, the pitches are too close now and no one can hit home runs anymore. We would have had to do that because I don't think, especially once you get to sort of Miller, Linwall, Hall, Griffiths, those guys, if they were bowling with those fields, they would have killed people, right? They would have had, like, we would have had so many deaths in cricket if we had gone up. So it's probably good that we didn't do that. Oh, Typhoon would have done it as well, by the way, our man. Yeah. So it's probably good that we didn't go down that. But at the same time, you do go, there was a way of winning test matches and you all decided not to do it.
Yeah, so I think you often talk about how the wrong one was considered against the spirit of cricket, right? It's like, imagine if teams were like, oh, the wrong one is just too dangerous. We'll never bowl it again because batters can't make it. Like, it sounds so silly, right? Imagine if teams were like, well, the wobble ball is just unfair on the bowlers. We're just not going to bowl it. Like, it's still so stupid on paper, right?
You're right, but it's kind of what just happened in baseball, right? So in baseball, after years of never moving the field where people are fucking hitting the ball, baseball does it. And baseball fans are like, whoa, whoa, whoa. No, the ball's not in play as much anymore. We want to see the ball in play more. So we're going to outlaw this very smart bit of baseball that should have been around for 200 years, and we're going to do it. So realistically, it is a possibility that these sorts of things happen. But you're right, 15 years after the wrong-in, people were still saying that it wasn't a fair ball. The first, you know, the story is that the first ever forward defensive shot had the same thing, right? Where someone said, well, that's not fair. So we've always had that. But it is interesting in cricket that these things do sometimes go away a little bit more. So, you know, realistically, I would have thought the reverse sweep probably should have started a long time before it did. We know there are people who tried it in the 1800s. But again, maybe there was an art, you know, people were like, what are you doing? That's not right. And so, you know, I think those things do dictate. But it is fascinating that England came up with this incredible method and then just went, well, we've done it now. We don't need to do it again.
So I'd say one of your takeaways that you had from the series was England usually do well in Australia when they had the bowlers that do well in Australia, with like the conventionally Australian-esque bowlers. That they had it in the 28-29 series. They had it in, obviously, the Bodyline series. They obviously had it in the 54-55 series, right? Those were the series where they had Aussie-style bowlers and obviously the 2010-2011. That was suited to those pitches, right? That was one of the major takeaways you got from this, right?
Yeah, and part of the reason I looked at that specifically, and it came up also through the research, but one of the reasons I was looking at that is because that's what England have been talking about since 10-11, right? They believe that they took over Chris Tremlett in 10-11, and he was a more Australian bowler than even the Australian bowlers, and they dominated, and obviously they had a really good team around him and everything else. What they've forgotten, of course, is they did the same thing in 13-14 with an aging Chris Tremlett and a Boyd Rankin, right? And it didn't work. Right? So you know, you also have that side of things. And so it is a lot tougher, I think, to just replicate that. But this bowling attack they have at the moment, Varun, is like the most Australian bowling attack they have ever brought to Australia before, at the exact time when the Australian conditions are more like English conditions than we've ever seen ever before. I mean, there's something kind of weird about that. It might still work, because especially with all of Australia's injuries, but it is really random that this is the time they're like, no, we've got all these guys. We're going to pick the fast guys. We're going to pick the guys who hit the pitch. We're going to hit the, you know, the sort of the metronomy straighty kind of bowlers like Atkinson, all these different guys. Oh, okay. Wait a minute. Actually, Fergus O'Neill is the best bowler in Australia now, and he just wobbles the ball around a little bit. Maybe we should do that. Scott Boland is now a genius. Like, it's very funny that they've come with a more, like, Australia might end up with a more English-style bowling lineup than England in this series, and it might work.
Yeah, so I think I remember once we were looking at the data and stuff. So we often talk about, like, in centre, how the conditions are different. Like in England, you have to bowl full because of ball swings. In Australia, it's like because there's bounce and you might have to bowl back at the length. But I think one of the things I remember looking at was, you know, almost every country, the best length is the 6 to 7 meter mark. So I wonder if there is an element of like, do you reckon people overthink team selection? There is an element of you just stick to what is your best strength. And maybe England have just been overthinking. I understand why England have done what they have done, but I don't think they needed to do it, right?
Yeah, I mean, in this case, who's the bowler they've left behind that you would have brought out anyway, right? They've got Potts available to them. He's probably one of the more conventional. Wokes can't play, and they've dropped Anderson, right? So I think maybe it just sort of fell this way anyway, but I also believe that one of the reasons they pushed Anderson out was so they could do this. Like they didn't want to be in a situation where they had to take Anderson again. So traditionally, when overseas seamers would turn up to Australia, they would bowl too short. It's a very, very common thing, especially at the Gabba and the Wacker, where, you know, at the Wacker, you really want to pitch it up more, right? Because the natural bounce is going to give you the what you want. And it does swing it there. And the Gabba quite often has a little bit of grass or a little bit of covering on it. And again, you want to be able to, you know, Queensland bowlers are generally pitch it up bowlers, right? They're, you know, so you do actually want that. But teams will turn up and play at those two venues and just bowl incorrectly because of the bounce. And so there's always been, that's always been another element, which is, it's a little bit similar to what you would say with India, right? Where it's teams will turn up in India with just spinners. It's not just spinners that you need. You need a particular kind of spinner, and teams are starting to understand that a little bit more, right? And you also need to be adaptive on different kinds of Indian surfaces to whether you bowl faster, you're slower, you know, whether you come wider on the crease, whether you come straighter and everything else, which again, Indian spinners are really good at. So I do think there is an element of teams working that out as well when it comes to Australia. And if you go back, teams used to bring fast bowlers over to Australia. In Australia, fast bowlers can go for just masses of runs. Like, there's this whole thing that Mark Wood's going to do really well. And I know he has infrequently done very well. But there's also a chance, if Mark Wood gets it wrong, that Australia is going to score at like 6 runs and over against him, because it's also a place that you could score really quickly against fast bowlers, right? Like, so it goes in both ways. So I'm not, Mark Wood's not the best example, but if you go back, the sort of Nanty Haywood type bowlers that teams have brought over, it's like, sometimes, even though it's so fast in Australia, it's also, you only need to get a little bit of wood on the ball and it's 4 or 6, right? Like, incredibly fast pitches, incredibly fast outfields, even when they're big. So teams do sometimes get a little bit confused with what they need to do.
So also, like, I think we talk about that the best way to defeat this Australian batting lineup is get early wickets. You want Head and Smith in as early as you possibly can. But just looking at the English attack on paper, Jared, I don't know if it's a very strong new ball attack. If the conditions are really helpful, like, it might not matter. But like, I feel like for whatever reason, they've somehow ended up with a lot of very good first change bowlers. But I don't know which of them is a great new ball option. Like, naturally, I want to say.
Yeah, I think if Joffrey doesn't take wickets, they're in trouble, aren't they? Like, yeah. Because they might be able to chip away at Australia, but you really want to be able to get Australia 3 down really quickly, because they've got this funky top order at the moment, right? Where they've got 2 players batting out of position and 1 player who's just not made runs for a long time. And so let's say Joffrey gets Usman out quite consistently because, you know, left-handers. He's still got to, you know, and the other two struggle. I think England have a big chance. But if they don't do that, England will get wickets because we know what they're like and they'll chip away and everything. But by that stage, Smith and Head might have just made too many runs that it won't matter, right? Like, there is a definite danger of that happening. So the new ball wickets, I think, are crucial for them. But as you said before, Australia have won home Ashes without actually making runs in the top order. Like, that is something that, if you go through the history of Australian cricket.
Yeah, they win happened. The BGT without making any top order runs as well, right?
Right. And so, yeah. And part of the reason for that is that Australia has probably always been a slightly better sort of 3-4-5 batting order than it has been opening, whereas England traditionally have been, you know, an opening culture, right? Every team has a slightly different pattern of where their strengths come from. You know, New Zealand's used to be 6-7-8, right? You know, like, all teams have a different pattern. And I would say traditionally Australia's probably better in that sort of 3-4-5 period. But also, they've batted deeper. That isn't going to be the case this time, though, is it? Right? Like, unless they have a really funky lineup where Green and Webster both play and they move, you know, Webster or Carey down to number 8, they're not going to have as much batting depth as they usually have. So they may not get the Mitchell Johnson bump that they got in 13-14 Ashes when he put a couple of partnerships together with Brad Haddin. So again, that plays in England's favour. But if you don't get early wickets, I think they are in a lot of trouble in this series, England. But if they get early wickets, then, you know, they've got the players to be able to capitalize on the flat pitches, right? If that's what we get. But again, I don't know if that's what we're getting. Pitches in Australia over the last couple of years have suited highly skillful bowlers, and England have what? 1 highly skillful bowler and Potts?
Yeah, so the other thing I'm just thinking of is, like, is this the sort of series where you want Stokes to, like, use his creative vision very often? Like, this feels a lot like you just want the bowlers to just keep banging in at the right areas. But I don't know if, like, I feel like Stokes has there's an element of ADHD-ness with Stokes, where I'm like, I think he gets bored just doing the same thing for a while, so he'll change things for no reason.
I think if it's one of the wickets we've seen over the last couple of years, don't you just want your bowlers to hit the length, right? Like, as you said, yeah. That's what you want. If it's not one of those...
I feel like Stokes gets bored.
Yeah.
But that's what I'm worried about him.
If it's not one of those series, then Stokes is probably an ideal captain to come to Australia, like, at any other time other than this series or the last Ashes. Right? Like, these are the Ashes he's probably not as suited to. So I think there's something to be said with that. Also, like, with Smith specifically, I think Stokes can really be exposed as a captain because he is a ball follower. right? And Smith is going to hit the ball exactly where he wants to hit it, when he wants to hit it there. And we saw with Cummins, who's also a bit of a ball follower, that like Root just went, oh, thank you, sir. Yes, I will take all these gaps that you're now giving me, right? So there, I think there's a couple of dangers with Stokes, but I still think that my theory at the moment, my working theory is they're going to make the pitches a little bit more batting friendly than they have been of recent times. Maybe not enough to change it, but a little bit more. So you still want someone like Stokes to, you know, pull some rabbits out of the hat and everything else. But yeah, it is fascinating. You're not wrong.
Yeah. Also with Stokes, I think like his bowling might actually be more important to them this year than his batting. Like weirdly enough, like I feel like they need him to bowl.
Yeah, well, I suppose
more than I think they need him to bat.
Yeah, if Jofra's not, not playing every Test match, and Potts probably can't get in this side, then Stokes is he's the third of the sort of skillful bowlers. If you want to put him up to that level, he's not quite as in control of his skills as the other two guys are. Like he bowls a lot of loose balls, but actual skills, he can do a lot of different things with the ball. Right. Like he's not like Cass, who basically just runs in. Right. Like there's a lot of, you know, Cass and Atkinson are much more, you know, a one directional, whereas Stokes can do a lot of things. So there is an element of that. I thought he was their best bowler in the last series. If he's their best bowler again, I wonder if they win though. Do you know what I mean? Like you almost don't want him to be the best bowler if they're going to win this series.
Mainly because I think we don't expect the batters to make the same amount of runs as they made versus India, right? Because the pitches are just much harder. Like, who knows what Crawley will do, who seems to be the best batter in the world against, like, Rabada, Bumrah, and Cummins, but, like, struggles versus everyone else for whatever damn reason it is. Ben Duckett against every single thing, like, whatever our eyes say, has completely defied us and is making test runs consistently. Ollie Pope, like, might make a very good 100 in the first innings and not make 100 runs in the rest of the series and do, like, a Virat, right? All of those things are possible, right?
But they do have a much deeper batting lineup, don't they? Like, with Smith at 7 and everything else. Here's a fascinating one for you. I really want to see if Australia used Bo Webster to Zach Crawley. Because of all the Australian bowlers who are most likely to get him out, it is Bo Webster with his little dinky 80-mile-an-hour back of a length bowling. Because remember, Mitchell Marsh got him out a bunch, right, too.
Nitish Kumar already got him out a couple of times.
Right? So he doesn't like medium pace at all. So I think you just bore him and you do that. And it'd be really fascinating to see if Australia do that. And if they do, if I'm England, I'm like, great. Everyone else has to destroy Bo Webster if he's bowling. Like if they try that, they have to do it. But if it's not, and everyone else is like, I know Scott Boland's not quick, and even Doggett's not quick. But if everyone else is 85 miles an hour and faster, that plays a little bit more into Zach Crawley's hands. But it's still, England could be three down for not many in a lot of games as well, right? Like that, there is the possibility of that also happening. I kind of think that my ideal test series is just that both top orders fail and it becomes a little bit chaotic and a bit of a shootout.
I honestly think this is a shootout between Smith and Root and Head and Brook. Like, I think that's what this will come down to.
Yeah, right? I'm kind of with you. I kind of feel the same. I think that, you know, those are the important ones. Brook versus Head. I wonder if either team can survive if their Brook or Head doesn't go big and the other one does. Right? Like, it's such an important position now in Test cricket, but also specifically because of the speed that those two score at. Head's been struggling for a little while. Brook hasn't been fully tested, right? Like, there's question marks on both of them. It's going to be really fascinating if that's what it comes down to, because if one of them has a big series and the other one doesn't, I almost think that's the swing point, right? Like, because maybe the bowlers will cancel each other out. Because England have, Australia's going to have to try other bowlers. They're going to have tired, older bowlers.
I think we haven't even mentioned it. Hazelwood and Cummins are out for the first test. They're saying Cummins is only out for the first test. He's probably out for the first two, right? At least.
I'd be shocked if he plays in the first two tests.
Yeah. Let's say Hazelwood comes back for the second test, which is probably fair.
But if he comes back and he's not fully fit.
If England don't win the test match without Hazelwood and Cummins, like, this could be one of those long Ashes series.
That's the other thing, I think, that I still think, especially with the Hazelwood injury, I think this really swings back towards England. But I still think that there is, if England don't win that first test, it's so tough because the second test is the day-night one, right?
Stark will come in.
Right. If you don't win that first test, chances are the second one's going to be really hard to win, right? And you've got to put a lot of pressure on yourself then at that point as well. Whereas if England win the first test, they can almost do what they did in 10-11, which is they drew the first test, they won the second test, then they went to the WACA. Mitchell Johnson has an incredible game and wins it for Australia, right? And they're like, okay, but that was the WACA. We kind of expect Australia to do well at the WACA. Let's see what happens when we get to the rest of rest of the places. And of course, they dominate the last two tests and win that series really, really easily, right? So I wonder if there's a slight element of that of you almost get a free play in the second test if you win the first test. If you lose the first test in New England, it's really tough. So it's like that could swing it all. There's still a possibility, even with Cummins and Hazelwood out, and even with England now being a slightly better side than Australia, there is still a possibility that Australia win this 5-0. But there right? Because if that first test doesn't go well and the second test they're down, that's it. They're 2-0 down at that point, right? Like, who knows what the hell happens from then on in? I don't think it's likely. I think, you know, you'd have to say at the moment with the injuries,
Australian batting lineup is too vulnerable to not drop a test match, right? That's what we often say. Like, if you don't have a good batting lineup, it's even like you usually will not be as consistent as you would with a team that has a great batting lineup, right? Like, and bowlers obviously give you the ability to win.
How many collapses did they have against India? Two massive ones?
I would assume so.
That one at the Gabba in the second innings, and they obviously had Perth.
Yeah. I'll forgive them for that because I think they were just over attacking because they knew that there's not a lot of overs left.
Maybe.
Their two would be, what was the last two? The Perth would be one and the other one would be, where did the first test even happen?
Perth was the first test. That was the first morning was the collapse. Or first afternoon.
Sorry, Perth and Sydney. That's the one I was thinking of. Perth and Sydney is where they had two collapses in the first innings.
Yeah. So it's not as if they were failing all the time. They obviously struggled to make some runs in the West Indies, but those pitches were, you know, not made for making runs. I think England need three collapses, don't they, to win the series? Yeah.
But England don't have a boomer to create this collapse, I think.
That's the issue, right? That's what I was saying. Yeah. You know, you look at the guys who've taken wickets in Australia, other than Shemar Joseph, most of them have been pretty highly skilled bowlers, and that's not specifically what England is bringing over. It's not their attack. So they're bringing over the attack for 1954-55, and that's not what the kind of pitches are at the moment. So I that's what I find so fascinating about the whole situation, is that England have kind of done the right thing, and it may still backfire just because Australian conditions have changed so much.
Yeah, so my hot take with Joe Root is, I think I was discussing this before, is I think he either has averages like 35 to 40 and England win, or he has an elite all-time great series and they lose 5-0. I don't think there will be a time where he will have an all-time great series and England will win, if that makes sense. I think one or the other will happen.
Yeah, I mean, he's the other fascinating one, because I think one of his big issues against Australia is just Cummins. Cummins just makes it so hard for him.
For whatever reason, he's very good at starting in Australia, right? I think he almost has 100% starting rate in Australia. He just can't go big. He seems to find ways to get out once he's set.
I wonder if it's that shot he plays in England where he kind of opens
the third man dab, right?
Yeah, that sort of point to third man shot. Whereas in Australia, like, the ball just comes that little bit faster. Right? Doesn't lose as much pace off the wicket. And so playing that shot off a length is probably just more dangerous. And I wonder if it's, you know, that's something we'll be looking at in this series, because he has also gone out at attacking and everything else. But it's not just that he's going out playing that shot. It's that he can't play that shot as much in Australia anyway, because of the, you know, the stacked slip score and the extra pace and bounce. And I just wonder if you take that away from him and maybe he gets a bit stuck after a start. Whereas everywhere else in the world, it's like, I'll just soften my hands, hit the ball to backward point, take a single.
Also, we can forgive Root for playing in some horrendous batting lineups as well. So I think maybe that can't help your mental psyche as a batter, right?
Constantly
looking at like 5'2".
Yeah. Is this the longest chat anyone's had about this Ashes test without saying the phrase Bazball?
Oh my God. Yeah, it might have been. You're not wrong. It's usually the second word mentioned every time there's an Ashes chat.
I've forgotten there was a Bazball.
Yeah, same. I'm proud of us, Jared. We didn't mention that once. So, all right. So that's all for today, folks. Hopefully you guys had a lot of fun. We both of us always did. Make sure to bookmark goodareas.co. It's the one-stop shop for everything. Thank you so much for listening, guys. We'll see you next time again. Bye.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bahram Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.